A quick announcement before we start. There'll be a conference dinner this evening after the last talk, which will be a very nice Indian or Pakistani restaurant called Artie's down on Woolloomooloo Wharf, about 5 minutes walk from here. It'll cost somewhere in the region of $35 to $40 plus drinks. If you'd like to come along, please let Ben. Does everyone know Ben? Ben in the front row here. Please let Ben know at lunchtime so that we can give the restaurants the proper numbers. Everyone's welcome. Okay, and now I'm delighted to introduce Matthias Michael from University of New South Wales, who's going to be speaking to us on maps, images, and truth.
Thank you. As I was saying to Hugh earlier, it was interesting listening to Tim's talk because so many of the topics I wanted to raise were raised by him as well. And so it feels like you're constantly going to be saying the same thing, but putting a different slant on them, I guess. This talk was kind of inspired by two quotes, one from Ramsey and the other from Austin. The one from Ramsey is one you'll be familiar with, that beliefs are maps of neighbouring space by which we steer. And thinking about that phrase, you realise in that one little nomic statement, he encapsulates three really important ideas. First is the idea that maps are integrated representations, that they're map-like, that they don't come piecemeal, and we'll see the significance of that later. The second is that these aren't just maps of some space or other, they're maps of neighbouring space, and that introduces an important perspectival aspect, that they are maps of where I am. And the third is this idea that they're the maps by which we steer. And that brings in the important idea that beliefs are importantly implicated in our actions. And that's not a new idea. That's an idea that was around at least as long as the Stoics. So the Stoic criticism of ancient skeptics who asserted that they had no beliefs or no opinions was the argument for slothfulness, the argument that said that without them you could not act. Right? And so you see again a connection between the idea of having beliefs and acting. So that's one cluster of issues I've been interested in. I'm particularly interested in the question of the character of map representations, what maps can show and what they can't. And then, as it happened, I was reading randomly before going to bed, and I read Austin's paper, Truth. And in this paper, which I'd sort of dismissed as, kind of weird, because after all he says it's the statements which are true, not the contents of them, and so on and so forth. And then he says at one point that he thinks maybe maps could be true, but pictures certainly couldn't. Echoing our mate Tim, he says that pictures can be true to, but not true of their objects. And when I read this, I thought, ah, this is mad. And he goes on to talk about other cases that he thinks are like this, transcriptions of conversations, for example. Phonograph records. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, God, he's onto something. So I started thinking, well, what is going on here? And that's what this talk is about. So I want to explore the question of the sense in which beliefs might be integrated representations, such as our maps, and what that would mean, and whether that would be a total account of what beliefs were like. One thing I would say, when I want to conclude, is that even if this idea of a maps like representation being the character of our beliefs were right, that can't be the total story, and that's because of an expressive limitation of maps as such. So I'll talk a bit about that on the way. And I also want to talk about the sense in which maps that we actually use can be thought of as true or false, and whether pictures can be thought of as true or false. And I'll agree with something Tim said, that that pictures in fact don't get to be truth apt, but I'm going to read that in as a rather trivial and insignificant claim, and once we've realised what that's contingent upon, we'll see that the significance of the claim for what perceiving is like might be overstated. So that's the aim. So let me start by talking about the characterization of beliefs. Any account of beliefs that's going to be worth its salt has to make sense of a really obvious distinction, the distinction between our explicit commitments and our implicit commitments. And there has to make sense of the fact that we can, by means of logic alone, extend our explicit commitments to incorporate or to revise them in light of what we come to recognise as our implicit commitments. So that is, that might be that we derive a contradiction from our beliefs and have therefore a reason for revising back and changing, or it might be that we derive a consequence, find nothing wrong with that consequence, and accept it into our corpus of belief. Whatever your picture of belief, it has to respect that feature of our beliefs. Incidentally, I'm not on this picture asserting that change of belief is always governed by inference rules which are logical in character. All I'm saying is that it has to be able to respect the fact that we can, in certain circumstances, revise our explicit commitments in that way. So that's one thing. Any account of belief must respect. So any account of something which is pretending to be belief has to allow for the implicit-explicit distinction. And given the way I've characterised it in terms of logical consequence, then it has to admit of logical relations. So whatever these states are must admit of logical relations one to the other. So you can see, if you've got a bit of logical training, you get all excited because all of a sudden you've got these objects that behave somewhat differently from just plain sets of beliefs, sets of sentences, sorry, and you can start exploring their logical power. That's quite an interesting technical question in its own right. The second thing that you'd have to take on board, and this is, I think, something that was alluded to by Tim, but I think wasn't quite put the way I would put it, so I'm going to say it my way, is that you must respect the distinction between the beliefs themselves, the nature of the beliefs themselves, and the character of the attributions of belief that we make to ourselves and to others. Now, the attributions of beliefs are done in language. And so people have who push the beliefs as maps picture have emphasized the difference between the integrated character of the belief itself and the piecemeal character of the attributions. Right, so the belief itself is an integrated representation. The attribution is done in sentence by sentence form. And typically, Tim didn't run this line, but typically people who run that line about global representation, say a picture or whatever, would treat an attribution as apt or inapt, as an abstraction from the information encompassed in that global representation. But notice that this is not simply a feature of global representation accounts of belief. If you have a sentence type account of belief, you can still get this mismatch between interesting complex relationship between the sentences used in an attribution and the sentences, if you like, in the belief box. They need not be that a belief attribution is apt only if it is the translation of a sentence in the belief box. Right? They're much, much more complex relationships can arise. There can be consequences. There might be, if there is such a thing as a language of thought, there might be a complex relationship between it and the public language used in attribution. So this mismatch between attributions on the one hand and the nature of the beliefs on the other is something you've got to focus on. This becomes important if you take on substantive views about the nature of belief. So, for example, a contentious view about belief that I have is that there is no such thing as a de-re belief. There is singular thoughts, there's thoughts about particular things, but there is no de-re belief as people have characterized it. And I certainly don't doubt that there are apt de-re attributions of belief. But these are kinds of attributions, not kinds of belief. And there's no special relationship between those beliefs of which, or situation under which you can aptly make a de-re attribution and the nature of the beliefs therefore attributed. This mismatch between the attributions and the beliefs is something you've got to always be walking around keeping in mind. And just to reiterate, that mismatch is stark when you consider global representations, right? The map-like representation, the singular attribution, sentence attribution that's made. But it's also the case that arises even in the sententialist picture. Okay, so it's something we all have to respect. Now the third thing we should try and understand is, well, what then is the content? What does a global representation actually say? What is the content of it? And we also need to respect that demand that they should stand in logical relations one to another. And we need to recognize that we have some give and take available to us because of the differences between attributions and what the character of the state is itself. One thing you'd like to say is that that literal content is in some sense not cancelable. If the map actually says it and it's not suggested in some other way, it's not part of the background interpretation, then it's not going to be something that you can cancel. Thinking about these maps and thinking about how you could get logical relations among them, that one of the things that you realize is, well, one nice analog to or introduction is if you take a map and then you take part of that map. You can say the total map implies part of the map. That looks like a logical implication. Certainly you don't get the other way. You don't get that part of the map implies the whole map, right? So it does. It looks like an or introduction type move. And you could talk about what's true according to the map. Now, unfortunately, there's been a lot of confusion about this notion of true according to, or made true by, in the literature. So, for example, some people have mistakenly thought that making true is an entailment relation, or they've even gone further and confused entailment with necessitation, and they've claimed that it's a necessitation relation. Neither of those claims is true. And reflecting on this sort of case will allow you to see that. Consider a map, and I'll be quick and dirty here, but you can actually do this formally. If you want, there are a whole bunch of things that are true according to the map. If you think that embedding a map in the bigger map is like augmentation, then what gets preserved under that augmentation is what's not cancelable, and so is what the map literally says. But there's a whole pile of things that are made true by the part of the map that are not made true by the whole map. So, for example, it might be that some generalization, every town is within 15 kilometers of another town. So that might be true somewhere, on some part of the map, but embedded in a bigger part of the map, in the bigger map, that generalization is no longer true. That shows you that generalizations can be made true by maps, and yet when they're embedded in bigger maps, that generalization is no longer true. So you have to make a distinction between what the map literally says and what the map makes true. What the map makes true is non-monotonic under augmentation. You augment it in a bigger map, you can lose some of the things that were made true. What's literally said stays true in a bigger map. So that is monotonic. So true on a map and said by the map are distinct notions. This tells us that if we're interested in what maps literally say, that there's an expressive limitation on maps. Maps can't express these generalizations. They can make them true, but they don't literally say them, or they don't have them as a literal content. This is why I think that going map-like without bells and whistles can't work to capture the richness of our belief commitments. You can get maps to make generalizations true, and you can do that with practices like presuppositions, that standing presuppositions, the interpretation of maps, things that are equivalent to that's all folk type clauses that people have talked about. The problem with that is that now each map is logically incomparable with every other map. The parts of the map don't stand in the appropriate logical relationships to the bigger maps. Now, so let me then put that bit aside and move on to another aspect of maps. I should say that, yeah, just this is also a bit where we do well to look to the past. Descartes, remember, told us that that it's inappropriate to think of ideas as images in all cases, that there are lots of cases in which we are misled by thinking of ideas as images. And it seems to me that this sort of similar limitation is cropping up here. Incidentally, I was speaking to Hugh, and I noticed that in the question answer between he and Tim, there was a rehearsal of another debate involving Descartes, that about the nature of experience between Descartes and Hume. Remember, Descartes held that being a good Stoic empiricist, as he was, that there is the receiving of the impression and the separate assenting to it, which sounded very much like what Tim was pushing, that the perceiving is the receiving of the impression. Hume retorted, as a good skeptic should, that for him it seemed like there wasn't those two states, that, as he put it, believing is more an aspect of our sensitive nature, that the perceiving is at once the believing. And that seemed to be what was going on there. I don't know whether Tim would venture an opinion about that later. But so now we're in a situation where we sort of have a sense of what maps can say, and we realise there's this limitation. They introduce possibilities, but there's a limitation to them. But now we come to this suggestive comment from Austin, where Austin says that pictures as objects are not true or false. But, he says, maps can be right or wrong, and what we say is that pictures show us something, but the map says something. So there's again this important contrast. And it suggests that pictures, like spots, can be taken as signs of something, but are really contentless. The spots don't literally say that you have the disease. I mean, there's this notion of natural meaning is a very misleading thing that people might get all excited about, as though there's this relationship in the world of natural meaning, and that's what the spots have, and it's what the images have. It strikes me that the right way to say to address this is to say actually the spots don't have any meaning at all, don't have any content at all. And similarly, I'd say the same thing about shadows. You know, shadows, we can learn things about the casters of shadows from looking at the shadows, but that doesn't mean that the shadows have content, that the shadows depict anything. I'm tempted to say the same thing about pictures as objects, as well. And that, I think, would fit with Tim's view. But let's ask then why images then don't have content and can't be true. Contrary to what Tim said, I don't think the problem is a lack of content and propositional content, if you like. I don't think that's the difference between maps on the one hand and images on the other. I think that that is something that that contingently we face, but doesn't need to be part of the story. Even if we could decide, and I think this is a real question, what the content of an image is. And remember, to think that it doesn't mean that we have to be able to express them in a sentence. And so suppose we had a good theory now. So suppose I was wrong that pictures do have content. So we had a good theory of depiction. Maybe that's what Ben is going to try and offer. Or a good theory of what's represented in a picture, if that's different. My view is that the real telling problem for images, unlike maps, is that we don't have the right practices involving them. Right? I think they're no different from sentences. So again, to advert to previous discussion, I really do think, and here I'm influenced obviously by Kripke's reading of Wittgenstein, that the whole idea of content being truth apt is tied to the notion of a possible mistake. And we have that practice surrounding assertion, and we have that practice surrounding map making and presenting. We don't have that practice surrounding images. Is that a deep feature of our relationship to the use of images? I don't think it is. You could imagine societies where practices evolved that involved the presenting of images in just the way that we present sentences. And where, importantly, you'd get the notion of the presenting of that image in that context being a mistake. Right? That's what it would be for them to be truth apt. I say, Tim's right, we don't live in such a culture. Is that a deep feature of us? I don't think it is. And I don't have a view really about whether development of such a culture depends on being a linguistic society. I really don't have a view about that because I don't have a view about what our pre-linguistic conceptual resources would look like. But I say that there's nothing particularly deep about the fact that images are not true, in fact, and maps are. What it interestingly reflects is the different sorts of practices we have involving images on the one hand and maps on the other. And we have, once we see that, we can see how societies would have to be organised, or groups within societies, so that you get the development of practices that would underpin the sort of normative assessment of acts involving images that would make them true or false. So there's in the original title was about the truth aptness of maps, and in a sense, aptness is a modal notion, right? But now it's a doubly modal notion, as I'm characterizing it, because when I say that images are not truth apt, I don't say that they are necessarily not truth apt. I say that's contingent upon real features of our the way we live our lives. I should say that also, that picture of things should make you think that The whole issue of non-conceptual content might be needs to be rethought, that too much of the time emphasis is raised whether there's an aspect of experience that can't be expressed in sentences that don't use deixis, right? I mean, the use of deixis the way McDowell does is a kind of a cheat because it involves that aspect. So that you might think that the real question, and the way some people have phrased it, is that it needs to be asked whether there's an aspect of experience that can be captured if you don't use deixis. Myself, I think that buys into too narrow a concept of what concepts are. If you thought of, I mean, they're going back to Kant again, they're in Kant, conflated as always. There are two concepts of concepts. There's the one which is this linguistic one that you can always have the I think, etc., and then the sentence. But as well in Kant, there's this idea of concepts as mental functions. And if you work with that picture, it's far from clear there's aspects of experience that aren't grounds of similarity, experience similarity, which is a one way of getting at this second picture of concept in Kant. So the question that was raised about whether there could be a linguistic, non-deictic sentence that captured any aspect that you wanted of an experience becomes a non-starter as an interesting question. That's not where the action is. Okay. I think I've gone faster than I wanted to, but anyway, I'm going to finish early. I should say that this question of what the content of images is a vexed one. I think that I've yet to see an account that I like. But on the other hand, let's not forget that the notion of the content of a sentence, although there's this superficial agreement amongst philosophers that there's this thing, a proposition, where that be a set of possible worlds or a way things could be or some such thing, there's only a superficial agreement about that. Even for your average sentence, there's no agreement about what the content of a plain old sentence is. So I don't think images are particularly worse off in that regard. Remember, even Lewis, who's the champion of the possible worlds account, I remember David endorsing Tihy's attack on Kripke. And Tihy's attack on Kripke, which involved gratuitous misreadings, but anyway, involved the claim that there are multiple propositions, those sets of worlds, associated with a sentence. Now, Tihy thought that these propositions could be distinguished in character. Some, he said, were expressed, so there'd be a proposition expressed by the sentence. Some were only associated with it. And he had a line to run. This is kind of the two-dimensional line. And then there's also the diagonal proposition as well. But there's many more. David's line on this was that he didn't think there was anything particularly two-dimensional about these different propositions. They are, after all, just sets of worlds. Or centered sets of objects, if you want, blah, blah, blah. He says, sotto voce, right? So you've got these different sets of worlds. According to Lewis, no one of them deserves the name of what that sentence expresses. In different contexts, he thought, different sets were appropriate. So I find myself disagreeing with Lewis, but let's be clear that this superficial agreement about what proposition is expressed by a sentence is only superficial. Just as the nature and necessity itself. I mean, we all now, unlike the early 70s, people feel comfortable talking about necessity and possible worlds. But, you know, scratch the surface a bit and philosophers don't agree about these things. So I think images are in no worse situation than sentences, really. And probably if we had a good normatively constrained practice, we'd get much better constraints on what is an appropriate presenting of an image in what context. You'd imagine that's the way it would go. I should say there are some Gricean accounts of depiction which are in the literature that I tend not to like. And those are accounts that say that an image depicts something just when, and now you have a family of clauses involving intention and various intentions. I tend not to like those because if they're right, then it makes our account of what the beliefs are like unworkable. Because remember, for Grice, what you were trying to do was to show how a certain psychology could invest, or characteristic psychology could invest certain strings with derivative meaning. So you start with mental content and get content into sentences. The problem with doing it for maps that way is if you're thinking that the mental states themselves could be things whose content is determined by what they depict, you're not in a position to do that. Now you've got a mental state having content only dependent upon other mental states already given their content. So we're not in a position to use such accounts of depiction, even if they work for public depictions, to give an account of mental content. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. You don't pop it out of existence, though. Yeah.
I actually think that there's a whole body of research that's being done at the moment. I'm not sure if you're familiar with W. David Mitchell and his idea of the control term. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's being said about the way that it's a much more visual world, and we need to start learning how to decode images in a certain way. But the argument is not actually just about images.
Right. I don't mean to say we don't have practices around presenting of images and the use of image, right? What I wanted to say was that you're right, the emphasis on mistake was the right one. I think that, I say this is quite contingent, so it might well be that we could develop it, or we might find cultures that have developed it, but that find the notion of an image being a mistake, that is, that it's that what it says about the world is wrong. Right. So it needs to be. So it's that kind of use of it which goes with that the tokening of an image is like saying a sentence. When I say a sentence, it's taken that I'm committing myself to the world's being this way. Right? And that's part of the complex social interaction that we've built up in the way we use sentences. I say, and I think that the that I yet to hear that we haven't. I say that we don't have those practices around the use of images. And I don't think that's a particularly deep point yet. I think we need to think of images as true or false. We need to be able to talk about the ways of presenting images that come with the sort of assertoric force that tokening a sentence does. And it just occurred to me, maybe like having a sign of a woman on a door as opposed to a man, you could say, well, no, that was a mistake, because that says that's the woman's toilet and it's not. Maybe that's one sort of special case you could think of. That is a different question, but what that raises is that we do use them in various ways for various ends. One of the questions that both talks have been aimed at is, can they be used to characterize our beliefs, our views about how things are? And both of us have said, in fact, no. I've gone on to say, but only because of the contingent features of our practice. We could have had different practices, and then they could have been. And I presume because Tim thought they didn't have the right sort of content, that he would have said that sort of practice is not possible. So you're right. We've been focusing on truth, and it's a special use of and possible use of images, not to say that they can't be used in all sorts of different ways, and in fact are used in all sorts of complex ways in the way we interact with them and create them and deploy them. Absolutely.
What you said about pictures, that in the case of maps, you seem to have kind of a systematic practice where there are rules and you can go wrong by not following those rules. Whereas in the case of pictures, or in the case of other kinds of pictures apart from maps, you don't have that systematic, so you can't go wrong in the same kind of ways. But I'm thinking, I like that so much that I think you should have said it about sentences as well. So for their literal meanings, you have a systematic practice and you can go wrong and try to use a sentence with the wrong literal meaning and then you get around this. But also when you use sentences non-literally, you do it without this systematic guidance from a practice in the same way as you're doing it. So it seems like you've got kind of a systematic use and a non-systematic use on both sides.
I'm not sure that the emphasis you're putting on systematic is something I would be balking at. What I said was that there are these practices. Now, whether those practices are because they have repeatable elements within them in the way maps do or words do within a sentence is not something I'm at all interested in this context or committed to. I could imagine a very simple language where the sentences of that language were holophrastic, that they didn't have parts, and so they weren't systematic in that way. And yet we could have a practice of assertion of making sense of truth, falsity, and the mistake. So I'm balking at what you think I was saying. I don't think that the practice depends on, in its very nature, what you're calling systematicity.
I meant to say just that
Yeah, no, that bit I'd balk at too. I mean, we know that there are all these different practices involving non-literal use of sentences, fictive, you know, sarcasm. And there's all. I mean, just go to places where they don't understand sarcasm, and you realise very quickly that there's what you take for granted, and the ways of going on, these people don't. So I'd book it that way of characterising the distinction between the literal and the non-literal too.
Right. So the same argument would work on the picture side. You say, go to places where people haven't seen cubist pictures before or something, and they're not going to understand. It doesn't mean... I guess there is a practice of cubist pictures, but...
Yeah, yeah. Again, this is...
pictures where you think there is no practice, you wouldn't be able to say, take this to some community unfamiliar with it.
Okay, remember, my point was not that we don't have practices, we clearly do. The question is the character of those practices and whether those practices involve the sorts of practices that allow us to identify the presenting of an image as a mistake so that it's false. And what you're talking about are interpretive practices, and I certainly think there are all those around our uses of images. But that's not... that's not exactly what I was talking about. I was talking about these other practices that involve that normative dimension that allows us to talk about truth and falsity.
Just on that point, are you saying that there couldn't ever be these sorts of practices?
Oh, no. Tim is, I'm not.
Okay.
Go
ahead.
Yeah.
I think you wanted to say that maps cannot make universal claims, like every city is within X kilometers.
Say, yeah.
Yeah. Because that can always be cancelled by embedding the map. But you know, that depends on the scale of the map. If you've got a map of everything, of the whole world, you can't embed it with anything else.
Contingently, yeah.
I mean, no, the scale of the map is part of the map.
You mean like a one-to-one, let the world map itself?
No, a small map in like that. Says, you know, so semi map is 10 centimeters.
Okay, but then I'm just going to disagree with you.
The key says 10 centimeters is the whole world.
Yeah.
And you can't embed it.
Why not? I've now got another, this is now another map. Mm-hmm. Why not?
No, but also, if you put it in a bigger map, I mean, that's meaningless because the rest, what's outside would be.
It might be mistaken in saying that there are things outside of this map, but it's not meaningless. In fact, that's a reason for thinking that it's not all introduction, actually.
The map would be false if you embedded it in something else, and you know, the resulting map
says
something bigger than the dimensions of the...
There's still a question of what the bigger one... It might be false. The question is, what does the bigger one say?
I mean, if you embed the small map in a bigger map, that will... the resulting map will be inconsistent because the small map is incompatible with there being anything...
Well, it doesn't say that's all, folks. Well, then it's only contingent that maps are connected, right? You could have a globe here and a globe there, or a globe inside another globe. I mean, let's not get too fussed about this. But yeah, I take from your point, not the point about cancelability, but now I realise that the point that I was making. That's right. The point I would say is that the bigger map, even if it's false, implies the smaller map. I mean, lots of false things imply true things. Yep.
That could be true, but I think it's inconsistent, and that's the point.
What's inconsistent?
The big map. Because the big map has inside of it the small map that says that everything is within it.
I'm claiming that it doesn't say that. You might write on it, everything's within this map.
Yeah, basically that's what the scale does, right? The scale says that the map passes everything. It's basically...
Well, the scale just tells you what the relationship between the map and the world is. It doesn't tell you that it's exhaustive, does it? I mean, just because it's a one-to-one map, I could have a one-to-one map that's this big.
No. That wasn't the idea.
Okay.
It's not a one-to-one. It's not a natural scale, like a one-to-one map.
Yep.
It's a small map.
Yep.
It holds, you know, I have it in my pocket.
Yep.
And on it, it says everything is on this map.
But that's what it
says.
Yeah, but now you're talking about something that's not, that's a part of what the map says, but not by dint of its map-like qualities.
The map of the universe.
Yeah, let it be that. But the bit of it that says this encompasses everything, that's not a map-like feature of it.
It is. It's what it's
doing. Well, we've got a string of questions. Sorry, a string of fingers on this one.
I don't think I agree with you that there are no practices in place that make pictures true or false. I actually think that in Western culture it seems to me that novels and pictures are taken to represent on a more abstract level. So when you read a story or you look at a painting, people generally, there are no practices that tell you that this particular story with these characters, this particular image actually happened. But people almost always in Western culture take some abstract level of that to be representing something about human beings in general, about general relationships. And I think people, you know, I think that there is a practice in place that people will take a painting to represent something about society and culture or the relationship between man and nature. And they always look for some sort of abstract relationship and will make judgment about whether they think that relationship really does hold or not. And their judgment of the, of, you know, whether they like an artwork or not, sometimes depend on whether they think it actually
is true to.
I just think there are.
I guess what I'd emphasize again is the difference between being true to its subject matter, even in an abstract form like the human condition or whatever, and true of, and I'd say that though we have these practices of interpretation, you're absolutely right, and uses of both stories and images, where we're trying to get at what the artist was trying to say, or what I can glean from this. But that's not quite the same thing as the practice that would allow us to talk about the presenting of this work as being a mistake, right? That it's false. And I think that if there were such practices, I would be pleasantly surprised, right? I mean, I'm not convinced that those cases are, though, such examples, but I don't have terribly much writing on it. What I'd be interested in is whether they come together, us talking about them being true or false, comes together with the notion of mistake, and just how that works. I mean, I'm interested in how that would actually work. I say it's quite contingent that we don't have those practices. So this is where me and Tim are going to differ. I'm not convinced that that the cases you've raised are cases where, even though we learn or reflect on the artwork, on the image, on the novel, I don't think those are cases of things that make those, the tokening, the giving of that novel, the tokening of that image itself true or false. In the way that saying a sentence is thought to be, that the statement itself is true or false.
Things are getting a little bit complicated here, because there were two things on the previous question. And then there are some more hands as well.
Did you explain the convention?
No, I didn't explain the convention. The convention is supposed to be, but sorry, I didn't explain it before. I hadn't realised that there'd be people here who wouldn't be familiar with it, sort of philosophical discussions in this part of the world. If you want to raise a new question, put up a hand. If you want to contribute to the discussion presently ongoing, put up a finger, and that way that enables you to jump the hand queue. Now things have got complicated because somebody who didn't know the convention jumped the queue and there are a couple of fingers on the previous discussion. I've also got a finger on the huge jumping discussion, but I'll resist the urge to give myself that one. And we'll go back to Ben's finger on Ben's point.
I am rudely interrupted and said what I wanted to say, so.
Okay, you might have a finger off the too.
So, okay, yeah, so that's quick clarificatory question on David's.
Right.
David's point. So, many universal generalizations are restricted in domain, so.
Yep, plus many of them, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so do you think it's within the expressive power of the globe to say all cities on planet Earth are within 15 kilometers of another?
In principle, yeah. I mean, there's another issue when we actually start getting fed income about thinking about maps. And that's the difference between the maps making a mistake and the maps abstracting. So, for example, it might be that the map shows roads and rivers, but not the shire boundaries. Or it might show, all right, so the question of whether the map is made a mistake or not is actually a really interesting one and not straightforward. It depends on the conventions that we have. But in principle, the restricted generalizations are going to be something that the map can say. Notice, though, that if the generalization has to do with something that could be thought of as abstracted from, so, for example, whether the roads are, how far the roads are from buildings. There are lots of ways of abstracting from that's where you put the road going through the town as opposed to the town being off the road at certain scale, and that's acceptable. So modulo those sorts of constraints, I'd say yeah. But the point would still be that the unrestricted generalizations are always available as well. So while, and that's the bit I'd be emphasizing.
I'm going to give myself my finger on the previous discussion. I mean, there's this disagreement.
The previous, you mean the
queue jumping one.
The queue jumping
one. There's this disagreement between Carlos and Tim in the both of you agree that the pictures aren't presented in such a way that we think of them as mistaken, but Carlos thinks it's contingent. Now, I agree with McCarthy that it's contingent, but I disagree with both of you that we don't do it. I think there are contexts in which we do it. I mentioned in the discussion after Tim talked the case of the journal, and it seems to me there are a lot more cases like that involving illustrations in scientific papers, especially but not exclusively in the days when we didn't have photographic ones. I mean, think of perhaps Galileo's drawing of what he saw through his telescope. It seems to be clear that we can say that he got some of it right, but it was partly mistaken because, you know, he put a crater where it was actually a blob on the telescope. Another example, and this is the contrast with maps suggested this to me. Think of something like a child's fantasy book where, in addition to the text, you have maps of the area described, and you have pictures of it too. It seems to me that in the context of the story, the text, the map, and the pictures are all doing the same job. They're saying, in the fictional context, this is how things are. And if a map kind of disagrees with something which is clearly established, sorry, if a picture disagrees with something which is clearly established by the map and the text, it's like, a picture's mistaken. It's not like this in Narnia or whatever the world presents. I think we do have these things. We don't have to add anything, just the general context makes it clear that pictures are being used in that way.
So that's the bit I'd balk at, or maybe I see what Tim would say, but I'd say that you've described a very particular context in which there are, rather than a general practice, you've got specific local conventions that take that into
We agree that it's contingent.
Yeah.
I'm saying, look, here's a contingency which makes it the case, in particular actual cases, that these things are treated so that they can be different.
Well, I'd say that's great, but I don't see that as a large language-wide or community-wide practice. I think that they're specific and local.
Well, it depends what you mean by community. We can draw our boundaries in different places.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, we've got a cluster of things there.
Just on that point, precisely, I think there's nothing wrong with talking about pictures as being mistaken or erroneous. And also, I agree with the previous speaker that there are different ideas of mistake here. You know, so pictures, and I think Picard would agree with this, that picture could show mistake and judgment, taste, or picture could be a bad taste or offensive or something like that. And that's part of our practice of using pictures as that normative connotation. That's true. All I want to insist in, so take the Galileo example. If there has to be such a thing as the picture, as it were, saying that, asserting that this is the way the moons are, then it must be possible for the picture to assert that this isn't the way the moons are. Because that goes with the idea of the duality of the proposition. It's got to be the same thing can be true or false, and so can be put forward as true or false. So,
okay, but
I say putting something forward as true or false, that practice, I can't make sense of the idea of that practice, which doesn't involve some non-pictorial representation too. That's the only point I want to make. But now you say so I think that's what it's agreed on.
I think I want to resist the urge to follow up on that because there's still people waiting. So, trust your feet. Okay, so let's finally get back to the hand. Patrick, I think that's
it. Seems to me there's a very well entrenched practice of pictures being true or false in geometry. In fact, the canonical way of proving certain theorems in geometry is actually by using pictures because it's so hard to prove them to be Euclid's axioms. We have to represent them geometrically. So we say, oh, this is a proof, say, of Pasch's axiom that when a line enters one, a straight line enters one side of a triangle, it will exit in one of the two other sides. But if you try and prove that from Euclid's axioms, it takes ages. It's really, really difficult proof. But you can, as well, give a proof or something like a proof pictorially. You say, well, the proof, the picture correctly represents the nature of Euclidean space. Definitely embedded. The geometrical images are a limiting case of pictures and images, and they can be true or false.
Even in that case, and certainly they facilitate proof. I just don't find myself wanting to say that picture is true.
It correctly represents the way the world is.
What, with respect to itself or in general?
Correct. It correctly represents the nature of Euclidean space. Some of these special functions of these pictures is to be. Representation is as close, pretty close to truth, Michael.
That bit on Borkat, I mean, that's where we differ. I think that they can be represented without having the sort of discipline practice that makes us say that the presenting of it would be true or false.
It seems perfectly natural to say an Escher, if you just abstract from an Escher picture, the geometrical content of Escher's picture, you say, that's false, that's false in Euclidean space. It doesn't truly represent the nature of Euclidean space because he's playing with it. He's giving us a contradictory picture of the nature of Euclidean space, which just can't obtain. It seems perfectly natural to say that's just false. It represents the way the world is, or where the abstract world is, then the nature of Euclidean space.
Well, again, there's the emphasis on finding an aspect of that you're going to take as the esoteric force of presenting an Escher print. And in the context it's, where
like, we have that representational property, whether anybody treats it in that way, it's, you know, things can be represented without being asserted. Assertion is just a, it would be representation without assertion.
But remember, it's common ground. Well, unless you're balking at this, what one of the things I really liked about what Tim was saying, and I was reiterating it, was that we do have a practice where tokening strings with content is associated with them being taken esoterically, right? And of course, that string has that content and is therefore true or false independently of that particular practice that we, that, well, that instance of that practice that we exemplify. So I say the same thing about those images. Yeah, they've got representational content, but and I'm not balking at that at all. I mean, Tim was. What I balk at is that we've got a practice that goes with the presenting of them as having esoteric force. Now, Hugh presented cases where I say, locally, you can see how they can be taken as having esoteric force. And I can imagine a sentence, you know, a sentence above the image saying, figure one shows that, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, of course it, yeah, it does. But now I'm asking, and of course, if insofar as I think it's got representational content, there's a question whether that is a way, a representational content for me is a way the world could be, or putated to be, is the world that way? That determines whether that content is true or false. And so I'm agreeing with one aspect of what you say, that it has representational content, but I say, in concert with Tim, the practice that we have of presenting images doesn't come with the, that sort of esoteric force in general.
I agree with that. I'm just presenting an area where an example. Tim, I mean, you're allowed with the contingency of language to allow.
Yep. Yeah, but I'm not convinced that the case is.
We'll point to these things and say, yeah, valid. We'll point to the picture and say, yeah, valid. Because the picture is
prescriptive. I've got another thing wrong. I think it's really interesting that it's tempting to say something like this, that the interesting point isn't, as it were, the contingency on the side of pictures, it's the sort of non-contingency on the side of language. I mean, I think it's arguable, and someone like Bramble would certainly argue that assertion is so fundamental in the case of language that you can't imagine a language for which it's not true, at least at some fundamental level, that the basic thing you do with it is to make assertions. Whereas clearly for the case of pictures, we can. And so there's the difference. The difference is between contingency on the one hand and the kind of necessity of assertion being embedded in the case of language on the other. Do you think that's reasonable?
I'm wondering whether that's, again, a contingent feature of the way we live. And that if we could imagine pictorially asserting cultures that were that whether they would be able to say that quite the same thing reversed or think.
Okay, how much time did we have left? Basically none. I think, and there was somebody who had a hand. Was it you?
I was just going to give an example of, I think that images can often be used, like it's a rhetorical technique to make an image purposely mistaken in an illustration, or sometimes inadvertently to do so. And the only example I was going to give was the New Yorker cover that had Barack Obama depicted as someone from the Taliban. And that is, a lot of people would look at that and say, that's wrong. And other people would look at it and say, that's right. And I think that that image alone opened up an enormous amount of debate. And the debate was around whether or not it was true. So I know that that's a very kind of abstract example of what you're talking about, but I do think that there are cases where quite purposely someone will make an image false to make a point about what might be true.
Yeah, I can wear that.
Okay, just around the right way. Let's finish the talking. Okay, in that case, I think we'd better wrap up now because we've got a fairly short lunch break. We're due back here at 1:45. apologies for a couple of fingers up to that. And let's thank Michaelis for a very amazing book. Thank you. A reminder.